Accession number 9168, roll number 12.
Mr. Amat, rail 12. What was the official attitude towards men going down the red light district?
Well, it was one of keeping a blind eye on something which was discouraged during that in the whole of the British Army, because venereal disease was rife in these eastern countries, and in order to avoid that, there was always medical inspections. When these men returned, they were all examined by the doctor, and anybody who had, not necessarily as soon as they come back, but a day or two afterwards, they were all put on a sick parade and examined by the medical officer, so as an earlier detection of any disease they contacted would be they'd be able to treat. There was we were warned, always warned about these things by a medical officer or one of the RAMC NCOs in lectures, and told how to differentiate between the syphilis and gonorrhea and all those attendant diseases caught through that sort of experience. But I don't remember anybody being put under treatment for any of their escapades. Anyway, after we've been there 3 weeks. Oh, by the way, whilst we was there, we had another taste of a regular army peacetime environment, and that is that they started getting back into the old peacetime regular army routines of everything was governed by the call of a bugle or a trumpet, right from reveille to lights out at night. Reveille was the first call in the morning, and on air in there, everybody had to supposed to get up from bed and make their beds up and get themselves ready for parade. Then there was the gunfire. That was the next call, and that was a soldier's expression of an early morning cup of tea without any milk, usually dosed with some sort of laxative, and an army biscuit. And then after that, you had to parade in shorts or running gear and taking on a run all round the camp before you were next call was cookouts, when you had to, you were marched to the dining room and had your meals. And all these calls were, you soon get to know them, and you knew exactly what you had to do. The last call was lights out, but before that there was a first post, which was sounded by the bugler or trumpeter, and a last post. And the last post was usually, first post was 9:15 at night, last post was 9:30, lights out was 10:15. And everybody had to be in bed with the lights out by 10:15. All the officer and all the sergeant used to go round and knock on the side of the hut or a tent, wherever it was you were, to tell you to put the lights out. Anybody who were caught with lights on and obeyed the order was immediately put on a charge and hauled up before the officer next morning.
What were rations like? Food rations?
Oh, we had the adequate rations, although whilst we was out there in India, there was no such thing as the beef and mutton and lamb and stuff that we'd had in this country, because the climate is such that anything killed during the day or night, you can't keep it more than a few hours before it begins to go putrid. So you never got, and not only that, there was no cattle as such, or sheep, India in those days, as we know it in this country, or had known it, nearly all the meat was buffalo, water buffalo, or goat, or a cross between a goat and a sheep. I forget what they called it, but anyway, it was a beast that was crossed between these two breeds. And these animals were killed in the morning, and about an hour or two before they were actually cooked for the dinner meal or tiffin at 12 o'clock. Anyway, after 3 weeks at Diwali, our draft was put on the train again, and we went back to Bombay. And from there, we spent the night in the siding, and then we were put on another train, which was going north. And we were going to join our unit, which was Number 7 Armour Car Company, stationed at Peshawar on the northwest frontier. This train journey was rather interesting because, as I say, we used to only travel about 25 miles an hour, and then after a few couple of hours or so, we'd stop for another 2 hours into a siding, and then go on again. These train journeys were very interesting because at noon in those days in India, that was a time when we used to call bang budgie. Budgie is time, and bang is the word for the every cantonment and garrison out there. They had a cannon, a ceremonial cannon, which they used to fire at 12 o'clock noon every day. This I gathered was in celebration of the time when the British actually took over India to remind the population that the British were still there. But not only did it take this aspect, but it also was a time for what was called tiffin, and that's the Indian word for lunch. And at 12 o'clock, religiously, every day, if you were on a train, it would stop before 12 o'clock. You'd hear the gun go off, then you'd all troop into the station, what was, well, I suppose, called a buffet in this country. And there, there were tables all laid out with white linen and knives and forks and plates, all ready for to serve a meal. And you sat down, and invariably, like the thyme, the bang budgie, it was always curry and rice. The only difference being is the ingredients of the curry. Sometimes it was chicken, other times it was water buffalo, it was called beef, and this other half goat, half sheep meat. Sometimes it used to be half a pigeon. All sorts of experiments were made with this sort of thing to try and get variety into the food. But it was always rice, and the rice used to be cooked not like the rice we normally have in this country as a after a sweet. It was cooked as a savoury to go with all the meat, and they had a special way of drying it so that all the grains were separated, and it was quite different altogether to this country. Anyway, the plate used to come along, and the natives were all dressed in their white clothes, ready to serve you. And this, mind you, was just ordinary private soldiers we sat down. No, there weren't officers, just that's the way we were treated in those days. And the outside of the plate was a rim of rice, and inside was the meat dish, whatever it was, what curry it was. Then after that, there was beer served, come off the ice, and whatever there was for a sweet or afterwards. And then after, at East, you always had a siesta after, especially after a meal. So we never used to start away again until about 2:30. And then everybody would be shaken up and told to get on the train, and we'd have another ride for a few hours before we'd stop again and take some tea, and then we'd go on again. And in the night, we invariably used to pull into a siding and have 5 or 6 hours sleep before we went on again. Whilst we were going along, I noticed that there was plenty of wildlife about. There was all kinds of different monkeys, some larger than the ones that used to be in Doolally, and had a grey coat with a black face, and they used to swing from the trees as the train went by, and chattering and chasing one another. Then there was also peacocks. The only type I'd seen all this sort of thing was in one of the London zoos. And these birds, at that time, I suppose it was the mating season, because that's the time when the male bird spreads its tail. And there's quite a lot of other... In some of the rocky places we passed by, there was flocks of vultures sitting on the stones. And also, if you looked in the sky, you saw the kitehawks swooping around and the vultures, because these birds were the scavengers of the whole of the continent. And any creature that died or had been killed and lay anywhere near out in the open, these birds would swoop down and devour it. We passed through a lot of these stations and halts, and everywhere we were treated just as if we were royalty, really, because in those days India was one of those jewels of the crown of the old empire, the Raj, and all British soldiers were treated with great respect. And if you walked along in a street in a bazaar, all the natives used to clear the way. They wouldn't nowhere near push by you. They'd jump off the pavement onto the roadway out of the way and allow you to go by. So that it's quite an experience to find this type of thing going on out there. But you soon got used to it and took the thing in your stride, really. We were 5 days and 5 nights on the train. As I say, we meandered along at a very slow rate, but eventually we arrived at Peshawar and station, and we were met there by, I don't know if it was a sergeant or one of the people who were sent down to meet our draft. And we were put onto a lorry and went back to the cantonment, which was about 3 miles away from the station. And this cantonment was a large camp with several units stationed there. There was the Royal Welsh Fusiliers, there was a Royal Artillery Battery, our armour car unit, and a branch of the signals, several other units there. And these bungalows were unlike anything we'd seen before in southern India. They were large stone buildings. The walls were about 4 feet thick, and on either side of these big buildings was another wall about 3 feet thick, enclosing a corridor which ran down both sides of the building. And then beyond that, on either side, beyond the corridor, was a veranda, a covered space about the same size as the corridor, all covered in with stone floor and posts all the way along with a railing. And the building itself was must have been about 20 feet to the eaves, these buildings, and large double oak doors, four I think there was on each side, and there was one large similar door on each end. And during the day, these doors were all flung back wide open to allow air to get through into the... And the great thing about these bungalows, another thing, was the fact that the windows were about 15 feet up from the main building, and over the top of what would I just described as a corridor. And these were not glass at all, they were just a kind of reeded curtain to allow light and air to get in. These buildings, I understand, were built by British engineers to combat the earthquake zone, which Peshawar actually is in. During the time I was there, we had several earthquake shocks, and these buildings, although at times they shook and the light bulbs and the fans swung from side to side, they never, nobody ever came to any harm. But
no. Okay.
When I got to the cantonment, I was interviewed by the OC. We were all interviewed by the OC and allotted various duties. And I've been a Lance Corporal, I've been in charge of an officer's mess in Iraq, was allotted to be in charge of the men's cookhouse. And this was rather an experience because the cooks in nearly all the regiments in India in those days were all natives, Indians, and you had to sort of chase them to do anything at all. They were a very lazy type of person, and I had to make the menu out and take a lorry down to the local butcher's, what the shop, it was just a slaughterhouse, pick up the meat and also go to the market to pick up green grocery, and then get the rest of the dry stores from the, what was called the chap who was in charge of the canteen was a babu. Well, he was one of the officials, native officials who reigned right throughout the whole of the British Army in India, and they acted as caterers for all that sort of thing between the natives and the military, supplying them with all sorts of groceries, and also in charge of all the canteens, the beer and cigarettes and all the rest of the stuff that the troops used to buy. The food was not very varied, and nearly everybody had complaints to make about various meals that was I tried to contrive to make interesting and varied. But on the whole, it wasn't too bad at all. The first year I was there, in Peshawar, that is, it was customary in those days for all British regiments out in India, especially the parts where we were, to be sent to the hills during the summer season. Well, the summer season used to last from October 1 year to April the next year. No, as it were, the other way round. It was through during the summer, from April to October. And very often it was earlier than that, in March. And batches of you, about 30% of each unit, was sent down the railhead and taken by train to the various hill station transit camps. The one I went to was Rawalpindi. And here there was a large transit camp, and this was used as a transit camp for the Murray Hills. That was a set of foothills of the Himalayas. And the first night we, this was 23, we spent a night in Rawalpindi in a camp, and we were told to, if we wanted a drink, that the canteen would be closed from at 7 o'clock instead of 9 normally, and it didn't open until 6, so we only had an hour if we wanted a drink. Then after that we were paraded, and at 9 o'clock marched off through the night out of the camp, and although we were a mechanised unit, everybody had to march on foot, and we marched through the night, first of all along a straight road, straight level road, then gradually after a couple of rests we marched on, and you could tell the ground was rising all the time, you were climbing all the time, and we arrived early in the morning, just before dawn, at this rest camp, and there these rest camps were built every so many miles up the sides of the hills, and each unit had to go up in stages, and I think we'd done about 10 miles all told, although it seemed a lot more because we were climbing all the time. We arrived at this first rest camp, spent the night there, and then started off the next night onto the next climb to the next camp, number 2 camp. And these camps were not tented like the other camps I'd been in, but were bungalows built on the style of the old Anglo-Saxon mud and wattle idea, and with thatched roofs. And these were rather lofty and roomy places, and the beds were made of wood, and with a rope or webbing lacement to hold the mattress. You also you carried your mosquito net with you, your personal mosquito net, so there was none provided in each bungalow. And another thing about it was there was no fans or punkers or anything like that, because even at that low camp stage, you were several thousand feet above sea level, 3,000 or 4,000 feet. So the weather didn't need any of these contrivances at all. And on the second night, we started off and went up higher up the road, and I think we reached about 7,000 feet above sea level in the second camp. Then on the third day, we made the last move, and it was a very stiff climb, and I think we passed the point where it was 12,000 feet above sea level, and we'd been told before that the air was very rare, and you'd soon be out of breath with least little exertion. We soon found this out, and we arrived at a camp called Kanspur, and here we spent 3 or 4 months up in the hills, away from the torrid heat of the plains down below. And it did really get very rarefied, the air, because when we used to play sports, hockey or football, we'd only play 10 minutes each way, and then have a 10 minutes rest in between. And even then, you had a job to run very far. But after a few days, you managed to get acclimatised to this shortage of oxygen, and you were able to go about fairly comfortably without any trouble of getting out of breath. We had some nice times while I was up there, and one night they organised a shoot to go out and get porcupine, and we waited till it got dark, and then we had some shotguns. A lot of the units out there, you could borrow a shotgun if you were a recognised NCO or a responsible person, go out and get a pass to go out into the mountainside or the woods and shoot various birds or animals. We went out this night and we got a porcupine. We took a native with us who was versed in all this sort of hunting. Anyway, we got this, they're large, very much like a badger, about the same size as a badger, with long quills sticking out from the back. And we brought it back to camp, and one of the natives took the insides out and cleaned it. And he showed us how to cook it, same as the gypsies do the hedgehogs in this country. They got some water and in the and some soft soil, and made a sort of a mud pie, and rolled this porcupine in it until it was all covered in one big long object, and then we got a fire going and put this clay cad body on it, and piled more wood and material on them until he got a fierce blaze going. Lasted for about a couple of hours, I think, and then the native cleared the fire away and brought this ball of clay, well, not a ball, but an elongated ball of clay out, and hit it with I think it was a small chopper or that type of thing, and the whole case split open, and when they peeled the two ends apart, all these spines and spikes came away in the clay, and they were left with just a naked corpse, very much like a little piglet, already cooked. And I sampled some of this, and I can't remember what it tasted like, but we all seemed to enjoy it.